Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Minorities in Publishing podcast. This is Jen, and for new and returning listeners, you may know you can find the podcast on Tumblr at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com, on Twitter at minoritiesinpub, and basically wherever you listen to podcasts, iTunes, I think that's Apple Music now, Google Play, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, and Spotify. So thank you for listening. We are recording in the year 2020 and looking very, very forward to the year 2021. I cannot even tell you how happy I am to have today's guest on, Portia Burke, who is Assistant Director of Publishing and Senior Editor. When you think stealth, I think of various Black women in publishing specifically, and that includes Portia Burke because she has been doing so much behind the scenes, in front of the scenes, all of it in terms of this industry. And we've been in kind of about the same amount of time. She's given so much of herself to this industry and to the mentorship and uplifting of so many people, especially other BIPOC in this industry. And so it's really an honor to have you on and to be able to talk to you today, Portia.
Thank you so much, Jen. You know how much I admire you. I've been waiting to finally have a conversation with you. And on the record is delightful. You are brilliant. You know how much I admire you, how glad I am for the acknowledgement of your brilliance so publicly from PW Star, but also to the attention that your podcast has earned you, plus your very vocal Twitter presence. So thank you so much for allowing me to be here and be part of your incredible mission to get the flowers for all of the BIPOC in this business. Thank you, Jen.
Oh, thank you. It's consistent mutual appreciation society on these episodes. That's always very heartening. It's what keeps me going, quite frankly. And funny enough, we finally work at the same company.
Woohoo!
The year of a pandemic. Go figure.
Right? We finally work together in the year that we can see the least of each other in the building. Poetic justice.
Nature is funny. The universe has a great sense of humor. And I do want to point out that Portia got deservedly promoted this year to Assistant Director of Publishing, and that you're going to kind of broaden even more of your horizons on everything that you get to touch. Anyone who knows, I'm going to ask the trajectory question of how you got into it. And I'm sorry if maybe that's a kind of repetitive question for you. But I think because of your background and also how long you've been in this industry, and that we have, again, I think a lot of synonymous thinking and experiences, at least how we've seen it over a longer period of time than those who have entered in the past 4 or 5 years, especially since the quote unquote diversity movement. I have feelings about that term. But people use it.
I've heard that one before.
Oh, yeah. So I started 2002, if you count my internships, 2003, if you count me actually getting decent compensation and benefits. And you started around that time in book publishing?
2004, April of 2004 was my very first job in this business. I came into this business from the music world. I worked for a hip hop label and needed to get out. I started working for that label in 2001. Great when you're 22 or 23 and you get to go to all the parties and you can have liquid happy hours during your business day, your liquid lunches and happy hours during your business day and go back to work. But it was clear by 2003 that that was no longer going to be sustainable. And I'd actually wanted to work for Random House while I was still in college, went to the University of Virginia and was not an English major though. And I had no idea about the barriers to entry at that point, right? Many of the BIPOC that we hear from in this day and age, the recruiting opportunities were not manifest to me despite the great schools that I went to. I had no idea what it took to enter into the publishing landscape. So me being an anthropology major and sending my resume, they laughed at me. And in fact, I like to say the record label I worked for was also a Bertelsmann company and was in the same building as Random House while I was working there. So
get out.
I Yeah, like that's how badly I wanted to work here. And most people who know me know this part of my story, that I was desperate to get into this company. And so I actually walked my resume. I will never forget this. I just got off the elevator on the Random House floor with my resume. This had to be 2002. Gave my resume to the lady, it was a lady receptionist, and got a phone call from someone in HR, who, of course, no longer works here. Like, that was the most unprofessional thing you could have possibly done. You will never work at Random House. That is not protocol. So, yeah. So then, by the time, you know, I really had to leave the music business. Long story short, I applied every single day for whatever job I thought I was qualified for 4 months. Sent my resume online for assistant editor, editorial assistant, again, not knowing the difference between each of those roles. And ultimately, I got called in by HR, by a Black HR recruiter, Lisa Clark, who we all miss terribly. And she called me in. I had no idea what the position was for, just went in. And it turns out that it was for the executive assistant to the president and publisher of the Random House division. And at the time, I was executive assistant to the president of the record label. So in many ways, it was a lateral move, but I was completely qualified for that job. When I interviewed with Gina and she explained to me what the job was, I remember sitting there like, that's it. This is all you're asking me to do. You're inviting me to have my dream job, but you only want what I do right now. Plus, you'll respect me, and my days end at 5 o'clock. There's no being on call at 2 a.m. to find a car service, and I get summer hours. I was just overjoyed, like dropped on my knees and prayed, thank you, as soon as I knew I'd gotten a job. So that was April of 2004. Gina knew that I wanted to be in editorial and immediately, you know, helped me develop relationships with editors to help facilitate that, reading for her, reading for them. And then in 2007, I moved into editorial, working for then the editor-in-chief of Random House. That was Jennifer Hershey at the time. I didn't come in with the kind of reading pedigree, literary pedigree that anyone else in this business had. So I overcompensated, right? I overcompensated by doing assistant work for anyone who needed it, thinking that that would be how I developed credibility in this space. So I worked for a lot of people, and I would answer the phone and do assistant admin stuff for whomever needed it. And one of those people was the late Bob Loomis, who is storied Maya Angelou's editor. And it was answering the phone for Bob Loomis in 2007 as an editorial assistant that I got to talk to Dr. Angelou for the first time. And the second time, and by the second time, she schooled me. She called me Ms. Burke. And I was like, Dr. Angela, you know, you don't have to call me by my last name because I actually hate it. And she was like, no. She explained to me that because Black women in particular had been so demeaned and debased by this culture and only called by their first name for so long and stripped of their dignity by only calling them by their first name, that she was going to call me Ms. Burke as a conference of respect. So, wow.
And yeah. It makes me think of that Oprah episode. I know you know what I'm talking about. Yes, with someone like Maya, and she was like, mm-mm.
And I, you know, so talking about Twitter, when that moment happened recently, it was back on Twitter again, and people were so up in arms, and everyone knows. I know where Dr. Angela was coming from, and that actually I wouldn't have been surprised if off camera she had another kind of talk with that young woman, right? To again, confer upon her the dignity of proper address in this world, using words to convey respect in a culture that tries to strip you and effectively strips you of any sense of pride and dignity you may have. I wouldn't be surprised if that woman had another, you know, transcendent experience with Dr. Angelou, because she could cut people down. I watched it happen in some very funny places, but she also uplifted and encouraged in ways that are unparalleled, legendary and iconic ways. So I got to develop a relationship with Dr. Angelou just by doing whatever job people needed me to do. And I stayed in that part of of the division for 6 months. That was 2007 leading into 2008. The advent of ebooks meant that there were dramatic changes and some, you know, it was an angst-ridden time. End of 2007, I immediately get shifted. I had only worked for my boss for about 6 months before they moved me to be the assistant to the publisher of trade paperbacks. And so I worked for her as her assistant for a year and a half. When trade paperbacks were a specific part of a publishing program, I learned a lot working for her and learned how to look at backlists and the less prominent, those backlist titles that are selling decently and so therefore could be candidates for front list publication, for reissue, for updating photos. At that point, we didn't have the words metadata, updating copy and covers, that kind of thing. I acquired my first book reporting to her. The funny story of working for her was that, okay, what we had relationships with, do you remember this, Jen? Especially, I know you worked for University Press. The relationship between University Presses and the smaller presses and the major houses, that we would purchase the rights to publish books that you guys had worked on in a trade paperback format, because many of those houses were only publishing in hardcover or publishing small. So that was my job. And one of the presses I covered was the New Press. And I acquired my first book from the New Press. It was a book called The Buffalo in the House. And very cute book. Also with some historical significance about the presence of the buffalo in the southwestern United States. But the New Press, the next book, so I have this great relationship with their sub-rights director. The next book that the sub-rights director tried to sell to me was The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander.
Again, I was like, was that it? Yeah, oh my God. Yep,
that was it. I had the galley. I went to my boss, like, look, I know this has an academic tone, but I think this is really important. There, she's making a case about the connection with mass incarceration to Jim Crow that I haven't seen anyone make this publicly before. This could be really big. And she was like, nope, too academic. Sorry. Nice you had it in. Thanks, but no thanks. Yeah. So,
and however many, years later, yeah. Even?
No. So, more than 10, still on the New York Times bestseller list. Mm-hmm. So that's the business. You said that. There were some other painful acquisitions moments that happened at that time and around that time. So that I worked for her for a year and a half. So the end of 2007 into early 2009, late 2008. And I then moved to go work for two editors on the Ballantine side, so our commercial side, all within the same division, which I know is uncommon to be able to move around a single company in this way. What I needed to add my value however I could, and I knew unmistakably that part of my value here is the way that I support executives. And I'm confident in that skill set. You know, that's something I know I can be great at, and why not lean into the things you know you can do well? So that moved me to two incredible editors who each needed something different in an assistant. Editor for cookbooks, and who was also doing celebrity memoir at that time, introduced me to Illustrated Publishing, Pamela Cannon, whom I still get to work with in some ways today. And then Melody Guy, who was the senior editor, solely running then our One World imprint. And One World at that time was very commercial. Again, it was part of the Ballantine program. So we were publishing what was at that time called urban fiction or street lit. We were doing commercial leaning nonfiction. We did a memoir by Ice-T. We did a book called The Little Black Book of Success, which is like career guide for Black women. We did Judge Karen, her nonfiction prescriptive advice book. Just a lot of fun, predominantly Black, although our mission at One World was One World, Many Voices. But it was a wild time because I watched how much support that list did not get. I had people definitely tell me, you know, you are splitting your time between two bosses and you're probably going to see more fruit from your labor leaning into one side of this job than the other, with the other being the One World side of my job. And I watched how much support those books didn't get. It was the start of Twitter. You look at my Twitter feed, you'll see I started in 2008. The reason that I even got on Twitter was because I needed to establish the Twitter account for One World. I needed to establish the Facebook page for One World. I was not on social at that time, but our entire company was dependent on Melody and I knowing the audience for this book. They were dependent on our authors being directly connected to the audiences for these books, because that was the only way that those books would find that audience, if we were a part of getting them there. Mind you, we're not marketers. We're not publicists. Right? We're not even associate publishers to be in control of the marketing plans. We are not cover designers. What it was like to have to fight for representation and for a cover that actually nailed both the author's intent plus what an audience was looking for. I mean, those were real struggles.
And this was, you said 2008. So this is upon that election year, the economic crash that came later that year. And so that sounds like a very intense time to even be establishing a brand.
It wasn't even to be established, because One World had already been in existence since the 90s, where at its founding, the founders of the original One World came at it from a much more holistic POV, right? They did have marketing support. They did have publicity support. And the way I've talked about it, and some elders in this business have talked with me about it, namely Marie Brown and Paul Coates. In the 90s, there was an interest in fully publishing to, at that point again, Black audiences, right? To the point that we're going to support them with an entire imprint that meets the needs of that audience. And we're going to give that audience the same resources that we're giving to everyone else. We're at least going to hire the people in those roles to give them the same support that we give to everyone else. But by, I'd say 2007, because the election of President Obama started to change the tide in a different way, by that point, Blackness wasn't popular anymore. There was always room in book publishing for literary Black voices. And yes, I do speak about Blackness, our diversity language, just because that's my space. That's who I identify. That's my community. That's the lens that I have. And as I think is the case, we've heard this, right? When you talk about Blackness, it can often apply in an uplifting way to other communities who are marginalized. So I'm hopeful that this lens offers that kind of insight. But there was always room for literary Blackness. There was always room for Maya Angelou. There's always room for Toni Morrison. There's always room for Edwidge Don Sakat. There's always room for a Roxane Gay, right? But not for those commercial voices that are, many of our colleagues look past on the street at best, or look down on in their lives, right? There's not the same kind of interest in the stories that their housekeepers or nannies might be reading. One of our books that my boss had in, and I can't recall who the artist was at the time. It was some celebrity memoir that she wanted to acquire. And when she brought it to her editorial director, actually, at the time, they were like, we don't know who this is. Sorry, it must be nice. Like, sorry, we don't know who this is, so we can't offer you the support you might be looking for to acquire. Went home, came back, I guess, after the weekend. They say to her, oh, you know what? I showed this proposal. I told my nanny about this proposal, and she totally knew exactly who you were talking about. So maybe we should take a chance on that. And you're like, are you serious that you have an Ivy educated Black woman whose opinion you know you care enough about that you have her on your staff, but that wasn't enough for you to believe in what she would bring to the table? It wasn't until you conferred with your help that you believed in the viability of this project, right? And that's the access to the other Black and Brown people that many of our colleagues had in their lives. And so, no, how could you expect them to have a fully supportive publishing program? How could you, especially when it wasn't met with the same degree of passion for particular audiences, for serving particular audiences at retail, which is something I still hope all of our diversity movements to learn the term you just taught me reaches. I really hope it reaches retail in a meaningful way. So
I'm sorry to interrupt, but when you're talking about One World specifically, I think a lot of people don't realize that One World existed prior to the reestablishment of it under Chris Jackson, a Black man.
Yeah.
And I knew One World existed. I didn't realize it was from the 90s, though. I didn't realize it had existed for that long a period of time. And you said that there were two founders of One World in the 90s?
Yeah. So Cheryl Woodruff is the number one in mind. And it was Anita Diggs.
Oh, Anita. Oh, yeah. Remember Anita?
Right.
She used to teach at the CCNY Publishing Certificate Program.
Yep. She's still in this business.
Yes, she is. I think we friended each other on Facebook. So Cheryl Woodruff and Anita Diggs.
I'm going to say Cheryl Woodruff and Manny Barron, because Manny began acquiring for Manny, rest in peace. We all miss him dearly. He was acquiring for Stryver's Row, which was the Random House version of the One World. And then Cheryl founded One World at Ballantine, and the two imprints merged together in the early 2000s and became One World, and One World published Stryver's Row.
There
was a storied One World history that included actually the history of One World founded by Cheryl Woodruff in the 1990s and Stryver's Row, which was the Random House version of that very Afrocentric at the time publishing program founded by the late Manny Barron. And so they came together when Random House and Ballantine merged to form a single imprint. And it was, again, very commercial leaning. The mission of Stryver's Row, rooted in the Harlem Renaissance, the mission of One World, really capturing, again, think about what was happening in the 90s, the burgeoning of hip hop and breaking into the mainstream, the golden age of that particular art form, the explosion that that art form had in film, right? If we're thinking about Spike Lee, we're thinking about television, Living Single and Living Color, like Blackness was very popular and it was very contemporary, very everyday Black voices were very popular at that time. But the respect that those voices had in literary spaces, there's a question mark. And you could see that by 2008 and 9 and the recession and the breakdown of a lot of our publishing income, so to speak, where we had to, quote unquote, I think a lot of people in publishing have heard this term, we need to publish to our strength, right? If you're hearing this, then that means we're reverting back to something that is very white and, or if it is, quote unquote, colorful, then it will be literary. It will be what we understand and what we think the broadest possible audience can engage with and that we know how to sell well. And if we don't know how to sell well to communities of color, then we're just not going to take those chances on those books for a while. And so that became what happened. We no longer published books under that imprint. My boss left the company and we saw that these books were not getting their support and we were both going to leave the business. And I was going to look for another job. I was actually going to go and work for Martha Stewart. I was in that interview process and went back to my boss to ask her for recommendations. And she was like, okay, you can leave. Like, you know that I will support you. And she's been kind of super supportive in my career. And she's like, or you can come back and work for me. And by that point, her job had changed because we had merged with Bantam Dell by that point. And we had brought Spiegel and Grau onto our team, which is how Chris Jackson got to be a part of the Random House empire, the Random House division in that respect. And the Dial Press came along with us, which is how we got the wonderful and late Susan Camel. So her job was different. She was like, you will have the bandwidth to still acquire, and we still want you to acquire the voices that we were looking for in the previous One World. And so I went back to work for her and did that for a number of years. It was not easy to acquire the books that I wanted to acquire. Again, I came from the music biz. I came from the hip hop world. I grew up in the hip hop world. So I came with relationships that rappers as storytellers, I want them all to get book deals and do all these great things. And at every point it was, nope, we don't do that kind of book well here. And no matter what powerful resources I had or alliances I had that wasn't as significant matched up against your editorial director's taste, your imprint publisher's taste, or their belief in what is saleable. So that was a frustrating time. And I thought, okay, I'm going to go back to school, which again, you know, you have a job that you know you can do. And that gave me time to pursue an MFA. Got my MFA, and as I was doing that, it was my first 4 year in school, I learned that Chris Jackson was bringing One World back. And Chris could have called his imprint anything. Like, I think that's one of the boldest and gutsiest and most admirable moves. Chris could have called his imprint anything. It could have been Chris Jackson Books, Ta-Nehisi Books, anything at all. But he wanted to have our company do right by a publishing program that didn't get its just dessert. And so he brought One World back and had the support of our publisher in doing that. Also a very bold move. And what's interesting to me, though, is that this current One World, there are very few books that, like, there's very little crossover, I guess, between those two One Worlds. Longer, it's just like very exciting. You know, you see the poets who, though, Nate Marshall for sure, I wish we could have acquired back in 08. The Black Futures Project, I wish we could have had on that list. I would have expected to have on that list. And Alicia Garza for sure would have been on that list. But The Water Dancer, I don't know about that. Between the World and Me, sure, would have been an original One World book. It's also a Stephen Grau book. But I don't know about The Water Dancer. The Water Dancer was much more of a Random House book than that kind of Ballantine book. And certainly published Styles P on the original One World, Dana Dane, Nikki Turner, Tracy Price Thompson, Angela Nissel. Those aren't voices that the current One World is publishing. And I get that. Like, in order to get a company to take seriously and do something different, he needed to make a clear distinction between the One World that hadn't succeeded in this space and the One World that would need to be not just respected in this space, but respected industry-wide. And he did that really successfully and really smartly and in a way that opens the door for so many more of those voices across our entire publishing program, which now is a behemoth for all of our mergers, now that we also brought the Crown Publishing Group into our fold at the end of 2018. Yes, there is a One World history.
And you are part of that history. That is part of your trajectory. And I appreciate hearing all of this because it's just like, wow, Portia's seen some stuff. Seen a lot of things. And it was a question I had for you before I pressed record was about being in one place. And you technically weren't in one place, right? Like, you were in different divisions and worked with different people and got to touch different entities too in terms of the product itself. But essentially, you are under the big umbrella.
I never left the Random House division at all. Not one.
And that feels rare to me. Like, nowadays, like, I feel like if someone started in the 90s and the 80s, it's like, okay. But I feel like, and maybe I'm projecting, it feels rare that I hear about people like, I never left this. And I'm like, never? Mm-hmm. Never?
Yeah. So it's a blessing. You know, some of what contributed to that are things I'm not as proud of. Again, you know, I said up front that I came into this business underread. Like, when I wear my well-read Black Girl t-shirt, I actually want to, like, write in "not that" at the top of it. It's like, not that well-read Black Girl. Like, that's how I came into this business feeling it. Not even imposter syndrome. Like, you're working with Pulitzer Prize winning, National Book Award winning editors, knowing that you didn't have that background while folks were spending their time after school in the library or in a bookstore. I spent my school afternoons in the Def Jam offices chatting with Redman and Flavor Flav and throwing shade at LL Cool J and hanging out with road managers for A Tribe Called Quest. So what would I be doing in this space? What I did in this space is I served. What I did in this space was support executives. And so when those are all the relationships you have, and those relationships are what you can lean on, right, in your employment, then honestly, I can't move very far from those relationships if I want to succeed. That's a very different way of being confident, of how you play your confidence in your job skills and in your abilities. So I can see and I admire my colleagues who have what it takes, who have the wisdom and the book knowledge and the understanding of authors and their titles and how they all fit together, and are so strong in that knowledge that they can be more mobile. But that wasn't me. My value add was my relationships. And so they kept me rooted. And people know there's some kind of a poster child for my company in many ways, but I then was able to develop that sense of the knowledge, the information, right? I work for a company that made it possible for me to go back to school, right? I had to do that on my own time. I was able to do that and upskill myself. So why would I leave?
And I'm curious about what you were saying, because you're talking about your background going to school for anthropology in college, mm-hmm. and the Def Jam and all those things. And they add an immense amount of value as well to this industry. And I question the industry or when we are looking for this kind of assembly line, mm-hmm. if that makes sense, where it's like, we all have to be that book read. We all have to be this. In order to even emerge within this business with an awareness of the business itself. And I feel like, I know there are things you learn and there are things you just inherently know that they will never know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm seeing is what value you brought from the very beginning is this completely other perspective for people who were quote unquote not well read. So how do we get mm-hmm. to those people? Mm-hmm. How do we get to them? If we're all sitting here in these silos of the avid readers, then we're just kind of mm-hmm. continuing to cater to that. And that's a part of what I loved about Lisa Lucas's campaign for National Book Foundation. She's like, I want to make readers. I said, that's what we need to do, because if we're going to survive, we need to make readers. Mm-hmm. we need to make them and not just assume everyone's going to always be a reader at the same time. So it's interesting you say that. And I'm always thinking about all these conversations that we're all involved in, and I'm sure you're involved in even more than any of us in a lot of ways, of what are we doing to bring in people like Portia Burke? How do we get Portia Burke when Portia Burke doesn't know that she wants to be in publishing?
So there's a lot. One, had you seen, there was some study maybe last year or the year before, what is time these days? But that Black women are actually the largest book buying demographic.
Yes, that, I always refer to that because I'm just like, we read all the time.
Right. That was one. It's about having people who work in-house and enough people, right, so that you can believe them, because one person is easily dismissed, as we have seen, as I have certainly seen. But when there are 10, 20, 50 of you, it's a little harder to ignore. So being able to have people who can say, yes, Black women are buying books and they are readers who deserve to be marketed to, who deserve to be reached out to, who deserve to be looped in on what you're publishing. That's one. And then two is that other piece is, okay, staffing has to change and recruiting has to change in order for staffing to change, because the spaces where we could guarantee someone, the spaces that we were used to finding candidates who we expected to succeed in this space were not spaces that were very diverse, right? For all of their own barriers to entry, if that's the expense of a Columbia publishing course, if that is the elitism of an Ivy League institution, right? We have now made a concerted effort, again, something I'm proud of. We've made a concerted effort to recruit with organizations like a Henry Street Settlement or like Year Up, right? Those organizations that are directly reaching out to
under-resourced communities to grant them access to spaces that they wouldn't have otherwise had. There are so many more of those kinds of programs and initiatives and thereby alliances for us, our HR team, that didn't exist before. So we're doing that. And now, over time, that we have had the opportunity to open the conversation to how exclusive we've been. You know, it's, you can get a lot of shade for having the conversation isn't enough, which I can fully hold. It's not enough to stop at having a conversation. But when you recognize that talking about, especially racial inequity in this business, wasn't something we did, right? We didn't talk about why is it that the One World editor also has to market and publicize her title. We're not talking about why can I name all of the Black people who work here on one hand, right? It takes actually being able to confront that and talk about it, and talk about it not just in an emotional way, but be able to talk about it in a fact-based way that can impact change. Which is why Ta-Nehisi's book was so important in our business, right? Because that book, and again, especially talking about my division, which published that book, it gave everybody a framework for having a difficult conversation about race and body politics that we weren't having before. And taking it past how guilty people may have felt, or how ashamed some of us may have felt, or how weak and unempowered some people felt, it took it out of feelings and brought it into fact and reality, supported, sure, by large and powerful social justice movements, which also, you know, were creating trends that we wanted to publish into. But that book in particular, because everybody read it, and it was short, so everybody read it, and everybody came to a conversation and an awareness about race that was radically different than anything we had done before. And with that, with the release of the Lee and Lowe survey in 2015, which, you know, publishers do not want to be embarrassed. And that was embarrassing for people who saw themselves as so liberal and so progressive, and who were in other areas of their life, if that is fighting for women's equality and pay equity and feminism and being more conscientious about LGBTQ audiences. They're believing that they are progressive, and they are. But here was this huge blind spot that they weren't even paying attention to. And so with all of those things, people are like, okay, you know what? Let's start to change this. But let's start changing in ways that we're still comfortable with, right? So we're going to change how we recruit for entry-level positions, right? We're going to start to make these alliances. We're going to start to be more intentional about bringing in BIPOC and employees who, you know, come from any kind of marginalized background. Like, we're going to be more intentional about that. But at the entry level, that's what we think we can change. You do that for 2 or 3 years, and they're hungry, and you find that they're very hungry, diverse, if they are queer publicists or Black editors. Like, they all, like, there's so many people who want to be in this business, right? So now they're here, but when they get here, they're like, pardon my friend, like, what the fuck is this? Like, you're so gung-ho about recruiting me, and you clearly had so much passion for me to be here, but when I get here, I'm being gaslighted every day. Like, I get here, and I'm hearing things still, like, oh, you know, we don't think that these people read books. There's a huge disconnect for them between what they would expect this organization to be and how it really is. And so then that has been a huge groundswell of change as well, because now those folks do have more seniority. They do know a little more about how the sausage is made. They do have alliances and relationships to help impact change. And that's not just relationships within a single division or a single company, a single publisher, in part because of the internet and how connected so many of our younger employees are and were just coming into it. Their communities are large. They're talking to each other. POC and Pub exist now, right, with all of its networking opportunities. Your podcast with you exists. There are so many different touch points for people to have a community, a very visible community that is forcing a lot of change to not just be lip service anymore. And so that's how they're making it happen. That's where my confidence comes from, that so Paul Coates and I had this disagreement, which makes me laugh because I'm hopeful that I'm going to come out right here, but that this interest in diverse publishing, to use a term, is not just a trend, that in 15 years will cycle downwards the way that it has every other 15 to 20 years in history, if you're following the Harlem Renaissance, to the civil rights movement, to Ms. Morrison being an editor, to Ms. Marie Brown being an editor, to Manny Baron, and then into the 90s, and then cycling back downward to where we are here, that the change in staff and the change in the vocal and expressive and very public-facing nature of our staff and their demands for real representation, their demands to really be seen, their demands for real agency, their refusal to just be quiet and accept mistreatment because it's paying dues. That kind of demand is going to make it really difficult for them to cycle backward and say, we don't believe in serving these communities anymore.
It's big hope. And there have been the consistency of articles, one that came out yesterday. That literally said, why is publishing so white? And it was so funny because it came out and I was just like, wasn't that a hashtag like 4 years ago?
It was. Yes, it was.
I was just like, interesting, New York Times. Very interesting. And they pinpointed, as you say, Toni Morrison and the direct correlation of how much books by and about Black people dropped when she left Random House as an editor and pursued her writing and also teaching more concretely. And what was always funny, I think you probably saw the commentary too, was that the writers, one person who's Asian and I believe the other person who's white, said, we were shocked. They're both journalists. And we were all just like, wow. Right. They're like, 95% of the books in 2018 were by white people. It's like, we're shocked. Or 89%, I think they said. And I was just like, y'all are funny. Y'all are hilarious. Oh, shocking. Oh, right? Isn't that a life to live?
Right? Oh, so clearly your career wasn't impacted about that. So like, imagine if you're the editor who only gets 5% of your shots are even possible. Right? Yeah, it must be nice. So the thing I liked the most about that article was obviously the inclusion of Ms. Marie Brown. And
yes, legend, icon.
Absolutely. And still out there, still selling books, still working with authors who are changing the game. And to see her again be respected and be a part of this conversation, it just deeply satisfied me. But the other thing is, they made it all about fiction, right? So their ability to get to that 89% number is because they were only looking at fiction. And if we think about the books that were on the New York Times bestseller list over the summer and how Black the bestseller list had been, those were all nonfiction titles, right?
And we've seen children's that. Lit too, but also kind of, right. It was racialized children's lit. It was social justice children's lit. So nonfiction and a couple fiction. Yeah, you're right.
Yep. And actually, so my take, and I'd be curious, Jen, would you agree with the voices actually that the previous One World had been publishing, right, moved into the children's space before they moved back into prominence in the adult space, which I'm kind of still waiting for. And part of me thinks that for the same reason that we've seen so much progress in terms of D&I in the children's and YA world, is that, you know, I think, would you agree that you see that from the agents too, who were selling to One World, to Atria before, and then to 37 Inc, to Amistad, that they pivoted into selling children because that's where the audience could still be found and the support for those books could still exist. Because no matter what, parents wanted a better world for their kids, a more inclusive and representative world for their kids. Teachers and educators and librarians were always at the front lines of understanding that those readers needed representation because they always had access to them. They couldn't turn a blind eye to their young Latinx girls who struggled with books that anti their existence. Would you agree?
I definitely see that as a direct correlation because admittedly, there's if we're looking at the bestseller list, and I mean indie list as well as New York Times bestseller mm-hmm. list, especially the paperback, mm-hmm. that is really dominated by BIPOC. Mm-hmm. Then certain stories like The Children of Blood and Bone and The Hate mm-hmm. You Give, which has been on for since... It's never left the Hate You Give. It's never left the bestseller list for hardcover anyway. I don't think it's even available in paperback.
Yeah,
yes, it's selling that well in hardcover. So I definitely see it. There's also the CBCC or the CCBC? They do annual counts just on race mm-hmm. of how many books and children's books are Indigenous, Pacific Islander, and such. And those numbers are pretty bleak. Too. And what's also increased continually, especially since 2015, is the representation, because they look at the representation versus the author. More white people are starting to write about us and making money in the children's lit world. And that grinds my gears too, because they'll be like, woo! Okay. We see who's benefiting from this. So again.
I'm not going there. When we get to have lunch.
Yeah, okay. It's like a part two, part three, part four episode where it's just like, and so.
No.
Yeah. I'm curious about all that too, because I read cross genre, but again, because I now work in children's lit and I volunteered with We Need Diverse Books for the first 3 years, just like seeing it so fast and just seeing how many agents, and you're absolutely mm-hmm. right, that I saw more agents start representing kid lit who didn't do it before.
Representation really exists.
And they were getting more sales. They were getting faster sales.
Yeah, we'll save own voices for another day. I don't know. What I can say is what's been hard to stomach is the white author who writes in a Black voice. And again, I know that my lens by using Blackness can feel very restricted and one note.
But you're right. For that. Dialect. And this happens so much in children's lit. Oh my God, I've read so many messed up manuscripts
mm-hmm.
about people really trying to capture slave talk.
Oof. Mm-hmm. And stop. So for that writer to then say, when, especially in this age of beta readers, authenticity, sensitivity readers, right, that those readers exist and writers can be confronted with some questions, right, about how fair their representation of XYZ community is. And the counter can be, well, I hear you, but I'm not writing my book for people like this. I'm not writing my book for Black people. I'm writing my book for white women to confront their whiteness. And so however I say it, if it's not offensive to them and is going to bring them along in their allyship, then I'm going to keep it. I'm going to set anything that you may have tried to correct. And what do you say to that, especially when the book goes on to sell more than 500,000 copies?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what can you say to that when you're like, okay, well, you're trying to make a difference in your community. And the way that you've done that is making the difference in your community. But it's still problematic and hurtful to the community that you're exploiting in order to make the point to the people who look like you.
And how do you even break through that wall of recognition? Because, again, you've had more experience in that, because I am coming from a more managing editor production background mm-hmm. for the past decade plus of still being in the room for some of those conversations, but not in those sales and acquiring meetings and all those mm-hmm. that I hear those really grating questions too. And it's very interesting how people just continually feel like they want to do good. They're not looking at the periphery. They're just looking at the end. So they're not taking in the world, the 360. Right. They're just looking at that kind of 90-degree lens. And right. I've seen it so much in the sensitivity reading I've done, when you get the dialect and everything, and people are like, oh, I wanted to write about slavery, and I wanted to show slavery was bad. I was like, we know slavery was bad. I have a hard time feeling like anyone in this day and age doesn't understand slavery was bad. I personally don't want another slave book. I don't want any more slave books, personally. I'm like, you need to be going somewhere very different if you're going to write a slave book. Per me. And that's my very, very specific scope and exhaustion. But it is so interesting to have these conversations and actually hear these authors just like the intentionality of just wanting to do good and reflect, and them not having the skills or ability to be able to do that at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's, as you say, I'm speaking to these people and I want them to learn. And I don't think what you say should kind of affect what I say, because my intention is good.
Doesn't capture is, wow, that they could rest on the rationale can also come back to you. Well, you know, they're not sophisticated enough to be able to make these kinds of changes. Like, that's a different caliber of writing that they are incapable of. You're like, are you serious? Do you know how many hoops Black authors who want to speak in their own voice about their own stories have to jump through in order for their work to be seen as having enough merit to be in this space? And you want to tell me that this other writer doesn't have the chops to deliver the kind of changes we're asking for, but they get a book deal? Like, really, the degree of insult that you're putting forth is remarkable.
Yeah.
And again, to our earlier conversation, I understand that there are people who would refuse to be insulted in that way, right? And people who, upon such an incident, would be like, I'm out. I'm not going to stay here if this is going to be what I have to face on the day to day. And I have to respect that. I know how, and for how many people actually whom I respect who made that choice. And I especially think about a lot of literary agents who had been editors in-house before they stepped down on their agency because they refused to continue to play that game anymore, right? I have a lot of respect for that. I just also acknowledge that not everybody has that sense of courage and self-confidence to be able to draw that particular line in the sand. I look forward to more people feeling so empowered, but I also have a lot of compassion for those people who don't necessarily have that wherewithal and are inclined to endure and look for solutions to improve their everyday instead of stepping away from it.
Thank you for that. And that's of increasing value to hear that, I think, for a lot of people who might be thinking about it. I feel like you and I are just in it. We're in it until retirement. Like, we're just like, all right, like, you can just keep giving me a paycheck. I'll keep doing my work. I mean, I want to simplify it that much, but we're invested. Thank you so much, Portia. This has blown by because I gave Portia like a whole list and I'm just like, but tell me more about this. And I've just enjoyed this so, so much. So I hope you actually come back because I feel like we just have a part two brewing.
I would love to.
Oh, thank you.
Talk about Queens.
Yes, we still have to talk about Queens. I might just have a Queens episode like you, me, and Danny Vasquez.
Yes.
And just be like,
yes.
Let's just talk about Queens.
Let's do it. I can't wait.
So, Portia, how can people reach out to you, not to submit to you? Because that needs to go through the proper channels.
Yeah,
and if you listen to this podcast for the past several years, you know what that means. But you are on social media, and if people just want to follow and hear about what you're doing, your teach. Also, and might want to join your class and get as much intellect as they can from you because you have a wealth of knowledge. Is there, like, do you have a website?
My Twitter is public. So my Twitter is at Portia. So that's at @PORSCHA_. And I'm there. You can DM me. You can follow me. I do generally follow back. I'm easily found. You can look at Portia and Random House and you will see more of me than you could hope for. So please do. I am here. I'm very grateful to be a part of the publishing community in all of the different ways that I am. I'm very inspired by this community every day. And I'm here to serve. Like, it is my purpose to really help connect people who have something important to say with the people who really need that message. And if you are a part of that network, a part of that world, you share in that mission or purpose in any way, I'm honored to be in touch and be in a community with you.
Thank you. And congratulations again for another much-deserved promotion and recognition of your contributions to publishing at large, but also the breadth and scope that you have brought into every position that you have held. And I love seeing that and so happy to see it, especially on the Igloo. We have an internal thing at PRH called Igloo, which is super helpful. Because I'm like, oh, that's where all that info is. So it's just really... really nice to see you shine in a year that has been cloudy. You have been that ray of sunlight, and I mean that sincerely.
Thank you so much, Jen. I really, really appreciate that.
And for everyone who's listening, thank you for listening. I hope your 2021 is going very well, that you're keeping safe. And once again, you can find the podcast on Tumblr at minoritiesandpublishing.tumblr.com, on Twitter at minoritiesandpub,